Hey, I'd like to get us into the text, Genesis chapter 11. What we're trying to do is wrap up the first of the major creation accounts we find in the Bible, Genesis 1 through 11. And let me start off with the very end of Genesis chapter 10, verse 22. These are the clans of Noah's sons, according to their lines of descent within their nations. From these, the nations spread out over the earth after the flood. And Genesis chapter 11 describes in detail how that spreading out took place. Verse 1, now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar, and that's the Mesopotamian or the Babylonian plain, and they settled there. Come, they said to each other, come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used brick instead of stone and tar instead of mortar. We talked a couple of weeks ago about how the fact that tar must have been quite plentiful for them to use tar instead of mortar, and indeed that part of the Middle East has a good oil deposit there, which would provide the tar supplies. And we find other references in the Bible to tar and oil deposits, Genesis chapter 6, where Noah was told to pitch the ark or seal it with this tar or this asphalt. And then when we have Chedorlaomer and the four kings going up against the five kings of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 18 and 19, there you discover that the Chedorlaomer and his allies were able to defeat the Sodomites by having them get mired down in the tar deposits in the Dead Sea Valley area there. So this is one more piece of evidence that these oil deposits, these biodeposits, were plentiful both before and after the flood. And I've referred to that in the Genesis question. By the way, we do have a new edition of the Genesis question. I think we released it last week, and so if you want to get the soft cover updated edition, it is available today. Okay, but we discussed in there how that is an argument that the flood, though universal, could not have been global. They said to each other, come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used brick instead of stone, tar instead of mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. And the whole context of this is God had already given to humanity four commands in Genesis 1 through 9 that they were not to stay in one place. They were to multiply and fill the earth, to spread out over the face of the earth. And so in spite of four specific commands from God to multiply and fill the earth so that they can fulfill the command that God gave in Genesis 1, 28 to 30, which is to manage the resources of the entire planet for the benefit of all life, and you can't do that if all you do is live in Mesopotamia. In spite of all that, they say, we're staying put. We're going to stay in the plain of Shinar, and we're going to build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches the heavens, so we can make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Now, I'm going to just set for you the geographical scene here, and then I got some questions I'm going to ask you. Yeah. Promised you a little better map than the one I showed you last week. And, this shows the Euphrates River here. This region of south and central Iraq is the plain of Shinar. According to at least my translation, the ark came to rest somewhere up here in the northwest, and people moved from the ark area into this plain and settled it. I do mention in the Genesis question how we have evidence that the first organized animal husbandry took place up here in the Zagros Mountains, which is up here, and the first area for the domestication of wheat, the Karasatic Mountains, which is a few miles to the west of that. And so that's more evidence that these mountains of Ararat, in which the ark came to rest, the mountains cover this region here, was probably in this location, and people moved down and began to settle this plain. Shinar is another name for the Babylonian plain, and in the middle of that Babylonian plain, they built this city, Babel. Most scholars feel that this city of Babel is probably fairly close to the city of Babylon, roughly the same location, maybe a little bit north or south, but probably right along the river in the middle of this plain of Shinar. They build this city, Babel. So, but the question I had to ask you was, what were the post-flood peoples really trying to rebuild? I mean, it's quite clear that they had this goal in mind. We don't want to be scattered. We want to stay as one people in one place with one language. And what really was their goal? What were they really trying to rebuild? And why was God so anxious to thwart this attempt? So those are the kinds of questions as we begin to look at verses 5 and 6. So from these first four verses, and from what you see in the flood account, what we just studied in the flood. I mean, in one sense, the people in the days before the flood had certain goals in mind that were counter to God's goals, and God had to shut down that building project. But what we're seeing here in the text is that in the same context, the peoples of the world are trying to repeat the errors of the peoples in the days before the flood. They're trying to build this kingdom. But specifically, what was their goal, their purpose in setting up this kingdom in the plain of Shinar? How is it similar to what the people were doing the days before the flood? And theologically, what was really going on here? Trying to make a name for themselves, there's something very important in that. Okay? Yes? No? It's a one-world government? Yes, quite clear. This is going to be one nation, one people, one government. Probably promoting paganism. That's certainly what was going on the days before the flood. Yes, Ross? Trying to create an environment which they would be free from the need of God. Okay? But you see some of the goals mentioned here. Okay, anyone else? Yes. Well, that's a good insight. This was not something they were doing out of ignorance. They knew exactly what God wanted them to do, and they basically said, we're not going to do it. We're going to pursue our own goals and purposes. But okay, anybody want to speculate what those goals and purposes were?
Who was it?
Yeah, a little guy in a red union suit that said that. Okay. All right. Okay. I think you've nailed it. That's exactly what mankind's been doing ever since they got kicked out of the garden. They're still doing it today. What did they have in Eden? They had peace. They were one people. They were united. They were in one place. And it was ideal. It was idyllic. Right. Life was easy. And so I think you're right on target. What's really going on here is that the human species is trying to rebuild Eden. They tried to rebuild Eden in the days before the flood, and they're trying to rebuild it again. And God's message is, you're not going to rebuild Eden. Eden is not the purpose I put you here on planet Earth for. I mean, there's something much bigger going on than just Eden. But that's the goal of human society at that time. And I think you're right, too. It's the same goal today. People are trying to rebuild Eden. It goes under different sociological names. I think utopia is something that was popular during the Enlightenment. Let's build utopia. But it's the same thing. It's the Garden of Eden. Return to paradise. Right. So even within the Christian community, and I think that's something that we need to emphasize to your comments, Kathy, is that this was something that probably encompassed God's people as well as the reprobates. They were all kind of working together saying, yeah, let's rebuild Eden. And let's set up this condition. Because there was this longing. They knew that Adam and Eve had this idyllic situation. And it says, hey, let's see what we can do to rebuild that. And God says, hey, it's going to take more than what you're doing to rebuild this. And by the way, I don't want to rebuild Eden. That's not my plan at all. Yes. No, I would completely agree with you that these are natural motivations. People want peace and security and prosperity. And this plain of Shinar offered all of that. I mean, you know, if once you leave the Babylonian plain from the context of those peoples, life is rough. You're up in the mountains. The climate isn't as nice, and it's much more difficult to develop an abundant food supply. And so if we can just stay in this Mesopotamian valley, one people, one nation, we can build a prosperous society, we can all live well, we'll be just like we were in the Garden of Eden. I mean, that's kind of the context of what's going on here. And so what God is trying to do is get them to leave their comfort zone, and, you know, who likes to leave their comfort zone? But God has his ways of thrusting them out, yes. Right. Yeah, I don't think any interpreter looks at this as they were really trying to build a building that would go all the way up to heaven itself, but they were trying to build a building that would allow them to reach a spiritual objective. So, well, yeah, most interpreters of this text argue that what was really going on was to build a gigantic ziggurat. And what that is a structure for making astrological forecasts. So again, this building was erected for a religious purpose. You know, God's not telling us everything we want to hear, so we're going to go to some other source. And so we're going to build this astrological forecaster, and that'll allow us to receive all this information we need to set up utopia. Now then, in terms of the occult today, isn't that the same message that goes on? The appeal of the demons that undergird the occult is, we're going to help you build utopia. And so, you know, put up this instrument and we'll give you all the help you need to set up your society. So, and you know, how big a structure do you need? Probably a couple of hundred feet high would be adequate, but it could have been higher. So when we hear about this tower, we shouldn't think of something 1,000 feet plus. If it were 200 or 300 feet, that would fulfill what the text has here. And that's still quite an imposing building in ancient civilization. You're talking 20, 30 stories high. Yes. Well, that's an interesting point you're raising. A name doesn't have any real value unless somebody else hears about it. But it could be just as simple as saying, you know, look what I've done. That's making a name for yourself. Or it could have been that they were so steeped in the occult that they were trying to impress the angels. You know, look what we're able to pull off. You know, look what we can do. But, you know, look at us as homeowners, right? We're always trying to compete with our neighbors and, you know, look what a great place I've been able to develop. So there's a lot of pride that comes just in building. Solomon writes about this in the book of Ecclesiastes. There's a certain joy that comes in building projects, but there's also the potential for real pride in these building projects. Yes. In fact, they could point to the pre-flood peoples and say, boy, they've really messed up, but we're going to do it right. You know, we know what's going on now. We've learned our lesson. And don't we often say that to God? You know, we've learned our lesson, and, you know, we know what to do now. And, yeah, I'm sure God's heard that a few billion times. So, yes. Quite possible that there was already people saying, hey, God told us to scatter, let's do it. And they wanted to nip that in the bud and say, hey, you know, we're not going to permit this to happen. We want to, you know, keep human society as one people, one nation, so that we can guarantee peace. So, yes, Liz? Well, I think what this is demonstrating, Liz, is that people, all of us, have this tendency to set too low of a goal. I mean, their goal was what? One nation, world peace, one people, let's rebuild and restore the Garden of Eden in this beautiful valley. I mean, that was their goal and purpose. And what's disappointing to God is that all you have in the way of personal destiny? And so in that sense, God says, hey, we're going to act here so that human beings realize what a really high purpose they've been created for. This isn't it. This is too low. Yeah, Ross. Well, you know, we talked about the Big Bang of art and the Big Bang of fashion jewelry. There's also the Big Bang of language. And it all dates to about the same time. 40,000 years ago, we see this eruption in language capability. Now, in terms of different languages spreading out, the earliest they've been able to trace that is about 20,000 years ago. Some think 30,000 years ago. So between 20 and 30,000 years ago is when you begin to see multiple languages. But in terms of archaeological evidence for speech capability, it goes back 40,000 years. And a lot of that is anatomical, just recognizing that, you know, we human beings are uniquely equipped in terms of our anatomy for easy speech with a high vocabulary. You know, other birds and mammals speak, but you notice their vocabulary is very limited. And I try talking to my cat, but he only has a few words he says back in return. They all seem to mean feed me or play with me. Right. So, but just in terms of the anatomy, we are uniquely endowed there. But the other thing they notice is that it's clear when you dig into remains as ancient as 40,000 years ago, there must have been a very high level of communication to explain the social structures that were clearly in place at that time. I mean, otherwise... Because you notice a huge difference with the Neanderthals. You see these family groups, but we see no real evidence that there was sophisticated communication going on. They could have done everything we see just by grunting at one another. And that was pretty well it. Their anatomy wouldn't support much in the way of communication. They're about as anatomically equipped as the modern great apes are. So, there was a hand over here? No. Okay. Another one? Yes. Well, I think that's it. I mean, most commentators make the link between what Satan says in the book of Ecclesiastes, how he wanted to be like the Most High. And you see the same thing being expressed by human beings here. You know, we can do this on our own. We're going to do this. We're going to pull it off. So, again, you know, setting too low of a goal, not listening to God, and God was asking to do some things that were very uncomfortable, but, you know, where's the faith? I mean, when God asks you to do things that are disturbing or uncomfortable, chances are he knows that it's got a really big payoff for you. And so people just didn't have a good perspective on what God's goals and purposes here were, and so they're rebelling. So what does God do about it? Right? I mean, he says, now the whole world had one language and a common speech. And so what God does is he starts mixing up the languages. Now, this is something that I would presume that people had an extremely high value on, the fact that we can all communicate with one another. Communication is something that's critical for human beings. In fact, I've often wondered if outer space visitors came to planet Earth and said, all right, what is the one thing that human beings seem to value above all else? Talking, right? I mean, they're on their cell phones all the time. I mean, and the farther apart they are, the more they seem to want to talk. I mean, you know, if you were to look at yourself as an archaeologist from outer space, it's almost like we human beings would rather talk than eat. We're just compulsive talkers, and so communication is something we value very highly. And God is communicating here. Communication isn't the ultimate. You know, I have other purposes for humanity that are much higher than that. And so he breaks up the languages into all these different groups, and suddenly people aren't able to communicate with one another as well. And certainly that would be a great impetus for disrupting this goal of one language, one people, one nation, world peace. You know, visualize peace. Ever seen a bumper sticker that said that? Well, I think that's what was going on in those days. They had all these carts going by with these little signs on it. Visualize world peace. And God is saying, no. In fact, remember people asked Jesus that question. Have you come to bring peace? And he says, no, I've come to bring division. Not peace, but division. We think peace is the greatest thing that we can achieve as human beings. And that's one of the things God's getting across to these post-flood peoples. World peace is not the greatest thing that you can seek. Or being able to communicate with everybody is not the greatest thing. Yes. Paul, what does it take to achieve world peace in the context of Genesis chapter 11 or in the context of today? What do you have to trade away to get world peace?
Personal
freedom and choice, exactly. That's it. So you have to give up your freedom to achieve the goal of world peace. Whereas Christ has come to give us world peace without the necessary sacrifice of giving up your free will, your freedoms. You can keep your freedoms and have your peace, but you first got to make your peace with God to make that work. There will be no personal peace amongst individual human beings unless you make your peace with God. Isn't that what we train people in premarital counseling in this church? I mean, if you're single here in the class and you come here for premarital counseling, that's what they're going to tell you. You know, there will be no peace between you and your prospective spouse until you both make your peace with God first. And your relationship with God has got to come first, because if it doesn't, you two aren't going to get along. It's just not going to happen. We can make a prediction as to what's going to happen to your marriage if this peace isn't there. So you got to get, you know, people say, oh, we can get along. But how long does it last? That's one of the reasons why I want the engagement, you know, in terms of my own counseling. I want the engagement period to be long enough for them to discover that they're not going to have peace without God's help. You know, I don't like to marry a couple until they've had a few good arguments, okay? I mean, you know, can you tell me some situations where peace between the two of you broke down? And if they can't give me an example of that, then I say, well, the romantic aura hasn't worn off yet, and we need to extend the engagement. Let's put the wedding off for another 3 months, because I want the two of you to have this opportunity of recognizing what it's like when you're not at peace with one another. They say, oh, we're going to have peace with one another for the rest of our lives. All right, let's just do a three-month experiment and see what happens. Usually 3 months is enough. So, and people say, well, why don't you believe in quick engagements? Well, that's one of the reasons why I don't do that. So, anyway, one thing he did was he broke up the languages. What else did he do? Scattered them. Okay, scattered them to different parts of the earth. And you get into Genesis chapter 10, what you discover is that God scattered different descendants of Noah to different places on the planet. And it's really interesting when you do a detailed, you know, I've often chronology of Genesis. It really follows the events of Genesis chapter 11. When you get into Genesis chapter 10, notice the detail where it talks about a particular descendant of Noah and his family, then the geographical area that God assigns to them. And you'll notice something special about those geographical areas. You had your hand up, but I want someone to answer that question. Yeah, go ahead. Okay, how is a decision made which group is going in which direction? My personal interpretation of this, looking at Genesis chapter 10, is that God made that decision. He was the one, yeah. Well, you know, in terms of God designing planet Earth, you know, let's look at this map in a little more detail here. We have these people, you know, here we have God, the Garden of Eden was probably somewhere up in here, and then people began to populate this Mesopotamian plain, and then God scatters the people over the face of the earth. One of the things you'll notice in looking at this map is how ideally it is set up to generate that scattering so that people will truly remain independent and separate from one another. I mean, I haven't got all the details down here, but when you look at the mountain ranges, there's a mountain range that runs all the way around this Mesopotamian plain, some places higher than others. And so when people are thrust out of that plain, there's a mountain barrier that's going to prevent them from coming back. And then notice we have these big lakes. You've got the Mediterranean Sea, you've got the Caspian Sea, you've got this Persian Gulf here, and then you've got all these different geographical areas where you got natural barriers, rivers and mountains and plains that really facilitate what we see here in Genesis chapter 11 of God scattering peoples to different parts of the earth. And as you look at Genesis chapter 10, it's like, okay, this particular descendant of Noah is going to get this territory, and these will be the borders for that territory, and every people group gets their own geographical area. Well, you know, in terms of just looking at it from the standpoint of physics and astronomy, let's just take a random planet that has conditions necessary for the support of life. Isn't it unusual, when you look at the globe, at just how well-structured our continental land masses are to facilitate a multiplicity of independent nations? You know, I don't think it's any accident. You know, God has set up the seven continents of the world and the geography on those seven continents with all the mountain ranges and rivers and deserts and forests so that you could have literally a couple hundred different nations, all with natural borders, their own language, and therefore able to set up a system where you have all these different nations, each with their different sets of citizens, and yet able to have some contact with one another. And that's going to be important for another reason. Yes. How do you account for the diversity of the races? Well, that's something that I've written about in the Genesis question. One of the points I make is that you will find no mention of it here in Genesis chapter 11. But personally, I think this is a good place for God to build in racial diversity. So that you've got different languages, you have distinct geographical boundaries for these different nations, and then the racial diversity to go with it. And you know, one of the points I talk about is, let's look at Genesis chapter 11 from the perspective of the 20th and 21st centuries. Because I think what we're seeing today is a breaking down of all these barriers that God set up to sustain competing independent nations. You know, these mountains and rivers and deserts and forests aren't the barriers they were 2,000 years ago. We have technology, we have transportation systems that easily cross those barriers. I mean, you say, what was the great success of the United States of America? You know, the United States exploded in terms of its economic growth because of when people began to populate the United States. I mean, if you look at the United States, there's all these barriers, geographical barriers, that would prevent it from being a United States. It should have been a whole bunch of little states. But the point was that all the settlement took place in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, when the technology was advanced enough that the Appalachian Mountains wouldn't prove the barrier that would have if North America had been settled, say, in the 15th century. The 15th century, crossing that Appalachian barrier would have been a big deal. Going up and down those rivers would have been a big deal. The Indians weren't doing too well at crossing those geographical barriers, but the Europeans, when they moved into North America with their technology, they were able to build a nation like Canada, a nation like Mexico, a nation like the United States, covering huge territories and remain united. And that's because of when all these nations were born. Yes. Well, Ross made the point, it's colder. Well, I think there, being Canadian, there's other factors going on here, that different peoples populated Canada as opposed to the United States. Scots, for example, came in, Scandinavians came into Canada, and in terms of which Scots came into Canada, it was basically the Highlanders. The Lowlanders didn't populate Canada, it was the Highlanders. And so these are people that were used to harsh climatic conditions. They were extremely independent. And, Canada, unlike the United States, is not a melting pot. If you look at the Canadian nation, what you have are people maintaining their ethnic groups that they had when they were in Asia or Europe. And so, where I grew up in Canada, the school I went to, there were all these different languages being spoken. And I found it difficult to talk to some of my friends because English wasn't their first language. And after school, they went to Ukrainian school. And so, how many Ukrainians here send their kids to Ukrainian school after the public school is over? It doesn't happen much. They tend to melt. They used to, yeah. But it's still common in Canada today. And people, rather than mixing, tend to live in their own little neighborhoods. You know, in one sense, the United States has ghettos. Canada does not have ghettos. You don't see these poor, you know, inner city neighborhoods that are populated by just one kith, but people do live apart. And so if you go into, say, downtown Vancouver or downtown Toronto, you'll find all these little downtown suburbs populated by just one people group. There's a Jewish quarter, there's a Hungarian quarter, a Chinese quarter, and you go in there and everybody's speaking their native language. You know, English isn't spoken. So it's a great place to go if you like ethnic restaurants. But that's the reason. It's not a melting pot. And because it's not a melting pot, you don't get the same population explosion going on as you do here in the United States. It's slower population growth. So even though the birth rate is higher. And then it attracts people that are very independent-minded anyways. You know, Australia is like that too. Australia is even a lesser population. But once again, it's the kind of people that migrate there that explains why the population hasn't grown to the same extent it has here. So, anyway, this is a little bit off the subject, but my whole point, time's up. Oh, boy, it's really up. Okay, hold your hands till next week. If you can remember your question until next week, I'll give you, you had your hand up the longest. Okay, real quick. Could I show you where Eden was on the map? Okay. There are some Bible scholars who like to put it right around Babylon, where modern-day Baghdad is. But most scholars, and I would agree with them, put the Garden of Eden as up here in the North Euphrates Tigris area, where it's low mountains, probably 3,000 to 4,000 feet elevation. It's much cooler than it would be down there, so in that sense, you got more of an idyllic condition. And the text does talk about these four rivers coming together, and the Tigris and Euphrates do join at this spot. And it's also the place where you see the first goat domestication and wheat domestication. So I would argue that that's fairly good evidence that it's probably right about here. And this text says that people migrated eastward. While they migrate from here into the plain, that's an eastward migration. So, roughly. And that would be a good location for the resting place of Noah's Ark as well. So I think Noah's Ark came to rest fairly close to where the Garden of Eden was. And that may explain the context of this chapter, this desire to restore Eden. I mean, after all, they were in the same geography, so let's rebuild Eden. Okay, with that, let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you that a text like Genesis chapter 11 has so much relevance for what's going on today. And Lord, the prophecies that we see in Revelation elsewhere that we will see a restoration of one world government, of people pursuing once again the goals that ancient humanity pursued in the days before the flood and immediately after the flood. But Father, we ask that you would use this coming period of seeking after and achieving world peace outside of your dominion, that you would use those circumstances to enable us who are called by your name to be a witness, an ambassador to these people. Father, I pray that you would help us to craft an appeal to the peoples of the world that would cause them to recognize that you have a better plan in mind for humanity, for them personally. And even this very week, Lord, I pray you would give us opportunities to help people see that we have been created for a very glorious purpose. And Father, may the hunger that people have for destiny and purpose, Lord, may your Spirit use that to enable people to hear the words that you give us to speak. And help us to speak those words in a humble manner, with respect, gracefulness, graciousness, and the wisdom. In Jesus' name, amen.